Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Bellevue University on Noon Forum. As school once again resumes today across the city, we'll hear a panel discussion on the topic, The State of Public Education in America Today, which followed a special screening of the 2010 documentary film Waiting for Superman, directed by Davis Guggenheim. In the film, Guggenheim reminds us that education statistics have names: Anthony, Francisco, Bianca, Daisy, and Emily, whose stories make up the engrossing foundation of the film. As he follows a handful of promising kids through a system that inhibits rather than encourages academic growth, Guggenheim undertakes an exhaustive review of public education, surveying dropout factories and academic sinkholes, methodically dissecting the system and its seemingly intractable problems. The members of the panel will include Reverend Dwight Ford, pastor and co-founder of Grace City Church, Dr. Eduardo Perez, professor of sociology at Bellevue University, Glenn Freeman, president of the Omaha chapter of the Freedom Foundation at Valley Forge, Frank Lemaire, a member of the Board of Education of the Archdiocese of Omaha and the director of the Four Directions Center in Sioux City, Iowa, Dr. John Spivak, professor of history at Bellevue University, and Dr. Ed Rauchut, the director of the Center for American Vision and Values at Bellevue University, which sponsored the event. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, May 11, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of Bellevue University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Rick Galusha, Professor of Retail Management and Associate Director of the Center for American Vision and Values at Bellevue University.
As I introduce our panelists, I'm going to begin from my right, which I assume therefore is your left, with the Reverend Dwight Ford. Reverend Ford is the pastor and co-founder of Grace City Church. He's an ordained Baptist minister of the National Baptist Convention USA and has served in the pastoral ministry for over 18 years. When Pastor Ford is not in his regular role in the pulpit of Grace City, he can be found traveling throughout the United States as a minister of the gospel and speaker to churches, colleges, and community organizations. He has shared the platform with premier preachers, world-renowned educators, distinguished speakers, and political representatives. Reverend Ford has earned an MA in Divinity from Harvard Divinity School in Cambridge, Massachusetts. As a student, he was selected to represent the School of Divinity in the annual President's Report, the winner of the esteemed Billings Preacher Award, elected president of the Harmaby Student Organization for Students of African Descent, and co-founded the Charles G. Adams Lecture Series. Additionally, Reverend Ford has served as a program coordinator for Harvard Divinity School's Summer Leadership Institute, which is an intensive program to train pastors and leaders in community and economic development. Reverend Ford has also served for 6 years in the United States Marines, and he earned his bachelor's degree from Western Illinois University with a concentration in business management and leadership. In December of 2003, Reverend Ford was honored as Western University College Scholar for Superior Academic Achievement. In August 2007, Reverend and Mrs. Ford relocated to plant Grace City, a Christ-centered, faith-empowered, action-focused, community-impacting church in Omaha, Nebraska. In addition to his vocation as pastor, he is the executive director of the Eastern Nebraska Community Action Partnership, an organization with the mission of eliminating the causes of poverty by strengthening individuals, families, and communities through self-sufficiency initiatives in Douglas and Sarpy counties. He's happily married to his lovely wife of 12 years, the former Shiva D. Batten. Together, they share a life, a ministry, and a vision of serving the church and the underserved populations of the world. Mm-hmm. Ask Reverend Ford to please make a comment on tonight's film.
There's an African proverb that says that he who walks fast walks alone, and he who walks slow walks with friends. I got 3 minutes, so we're going to have to jog at a brisk pace. I'm glad to be here, and of course, with this esteemed panel, and to have an opportunity to comment on something I think is very important, which is education. I bring a particular perspective just to give you a very thin lens and still be able to take care of this in 3 minutes, is that I've had an opportunity to work within private schools. I've helped to start and found a 300 enrollment beginning charter school in the state of Florida. I've also had an opportunity to work in the public school system as a behavior disorder classroom instructor and also work as a juvenile boot camp drill instructor when education and behavior doesn't meet the kind of standards that they ought to. So I bring a particular interest in this, and my focus has always been with the children. I think what the documentary did do is clarify the importance of having quality teachers. Nothing moves forward without that, and you can see time and time again where I believe that emphasis should be upon quality teachers. I think we cannot leave this discussion this evening without at least tackling the idea of tenure. I think the Chancellor Ray had a wonderful idea of using within the system and bringing to at least an advantage of how they can move forward with that. The unions, and you can hear a lot about the unions themselves. I would hope that they would have had a representative here tonight. But the film was kind of heavy-handed toward the unions. One of the things that we ought to do is also take a look at Finland, which scored the highest in standardized testing in the world, rather. They're 100% unions. So I don't think the issue is unions. I don't think the issue by themselves are unions. And I think when people are generally concerned about the students, they'll make every effort to keep the focus where it ought to be. Then I think charter schools were lifted up at a level because I was in a state where charter schools were frequent. I've seen the best and I've seen the absolute worst of charter schools. I've seen what people get involved with the hopes of making them more entrepreneurial than educational. And so I bring that perspective, and hopefully we can talk about those as well. There's no silver bullet to this, and I think the documentary didn't cover a couple of things that I would hope that they would have, and maybe that there'll be a part two following the students that didn't get into the opportunities and the students that had to return back to those failing schools. One of the things that they did focus on, and they didn't make it so known, which is the family or parental involvement in the young person's life. That's something refreshing to see. But what about those parents that are not as involved, and how do we still help those young people without holding it on the weight of those young people to have to come to grips with that? Once again, there's no silver bullet. I would hope that the documentary would also discover or at least talk about gender-specific classrooms and also talk about ethnic classrooms as well, where education doesn't work at and doesn't enhance the lives of so many minority students. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next panelist is Dr. Eduardo Perez. Dr. Perez has a PhD in sociology with a specialty of education in higher education, social inequality, and social theory. He has his bachelor's degree from California State University, Fresno, so he's looking forward to the game this fall. He has an MA and a PhD from the University of Nebraska. Dr. Perez's primary research interest is investigating how Hispanic faculty members negotiate tenure and promotion at research universities. Special attention is given to the organizational procedures and systems which undermine the recruitment and the retention of minority faculty members in the United States. Having several publications teaching sociology, social focus, and others, he's been published frequently. Originally born in Mexico, first-generation working immigrant, as a student, he is the product of a bilingual, upward-bound, multicultural education. Taught 1 year in inner-city schools as he prepared to enter the K-12 teaching profession and changed his mind to pursue the MA and the PhD in sociology. Would you please join me in welcoming Dr. Perez?
Hello, welcome tonight. I wanna thank each and every one of you for coming, especially my students who have made it tonight, a special effort to be here and waiting for that extra credit to come along in. It usually takes about 10 minutes to introduce a topic, so for my classes. So 3 minutes is a race, so I was hydrating here so I can select what I want to talk about. The movie. It was a very sobering experience. I've seen it before, and I'm not sure how the director got away without copyrights. John Stossel made a similar movie called Stupid in America that covers about the same topics. It is very heartening, but for me, there were some points that were more salient, having had that background and training. First, I want to pick on the issue of race, and I probably put my foot in my mouth, because I often do, But it was very interesting how the students who were struggling in this movie were all minority. And I found it troublesome that the movie did not depict a single white struggling student in America. Now, one student was identified, and I believe she was already in high school going to a very good school, but was actually trying to get into a lottery to go into a better school. And unlike most Americans, her mom had an English accent. And so it typifies for me what the model minorities are in terms of who is successful and who is not in America, which reproduces that stereotype that certain groups are not worthy of attention when they're failing. Another thing I want to point out is that the person in charge in Washington, D.C. was selected, you know, as the person that was going to resolve the Washington, D.C. school problem, while New York has one of the largest struggling school systems in the United States. And so it's particularly interesting that an Asian American woman was selected as the model minority to show its success. But as we all saw, when you actually try to change the systemic problems that come from above, you meet certain barriers, and those barriers are the increasing bureaucracies in universities and all the way down to kindergarten that disempowers the teachers themselves in determining the direction of what education should be. The second topic I want to talk about is our culture. I am so happy we're number one at confidence. I love that statistics, you know. Our culture has changed dramatically where we have softened our approach in terms of our authority towards minors and towards our students, with that beginning with parents that are treating our students, of course, as friends rather than parents. And along the line, the increase in attention that helicopter parents have received has caused a lot of tension in schools. We have a very high self-esteem, and unfortunately, much of the public school system is not concentrating on self-efficacy, which actually has a more significant determinant of success in achievement scores, math or English, which are the only two that we really try to look at internationally. When we do try to increase the efficacy standards, that is, having higher standards for our students, the unions show up with a certain competition as to whether or not even a proposal to let teachers decide to have either tenure, which they gain in 2 years, or have merit pay and double their salary. As you all saw, there was a mute vote, and we're not allowed to vote. So our culture has changed significantly in that we have softened our approach to what matters more in having higher expectations and standards for our students and rather catering to students as customers. The third part I want to talk about is, of course, politics. It's interesting for me to know that during the Reagan administrations, we did have the Nation at Risk proposal, the first study to find out why we were failing. Our school systems were considered a mediocrity, and it didn't really capture enthusiasm by the teachers. Then I believe Bill Clinton came along and also had a very ambitious plan called Goals 2000, and by the turn of the century, we were going to have equal 100% achievement standards on every single subject. George Bush came around and proposed No Child Left Behind. I was very concerned with the most recent administration because if I were to ask you to name the national policy on education today, you'll have a hard time naming it. We don't really have one. We continue the No Child Left Behind from previous administrations, but there's no name for the new one. The only thing that it did is really we changed the standards and expectations for teachers. No Child Left Behind put accountability for teachers' performance, and now we've taken that away and gone back to the approach where expectations are no longer required of teachers. Interestingly enough, the same person from Stanford University was in charge of the U.S. Department of Education determining where that should lead. Thank you.
Our next panelist is Mr. Glenn Freeman. Mr. Freeman proudly served for 30 years in the United States Air Force. His military decorations include the Bronze Star, 3 Meritorious Service Medals, 4 Air Force Commendation Medals, and the Air Force Outstanding Unit Award with Combat Valor. Upon retirement from the Air Force in 1985, Glenn became active in politics. He served on both the Douglas County Republican Party and the Nebraska Republican Party Executive Committee as Assistant Chairman and concurrently as the Chairman of the Outreach Committee. In addition, he is a former chairman of the Douglas County Republican Party and the Republican Forum. From 1991 to 1997, Glenn served as the Hospital Service Coordinator for Disabled American Veterans, a veteran service organization. Glenn was most recently a senior aide to United States Senator Chuck Hagel, serving as a special assistant for the Military and Veteran Affairs. Glenn is now the president of the Omaha chapter of the Freedom Foundation at Valley Forge. Please join me in welcoming Glenn.
Hey.
Well, thank you so very much for inviting me to be here. I think that I will give a different perspective to the discussion. I hadn't seen the movie before, but I was struck by the fact that it dealt with Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. is my home. All of my education, terminal education, was in Washington, D.C. So I can give you the before and after if we have the chance to do it. But at my what I see with the film, I didn't think too much of the film, I have to be honest with you, because the only thing that I got out of the film was that children will meet your expectation. If you expect something out of them, you'll get it. If you don't expect anything, you won't get it. And I say that because of the OPS. They have all kind of programs for black students. They have the Benjamin Banneker program for math. I didn't know till recently, until I came to OPS here a few years, that blacks weren't good at math. I didn't know that. That was new to me. And then it was ironic that they would use Benjamin Banneker. Now, we all know that Benjamin Banneker was the architect that finished Washington, D.C. when Pierre Lafont got mad and went home to France. Thomas Jefferson got Benjamin Banneker to finish the design in Washington. So, like I said, I have a different view of this, but I want to thank Bellevue for putting this on. I think we can get something worthwhile out of this. So I am not here to say amen. I'm here to give you my view. Again, thank you for asking me.
Our next panelist is Mr. Frank LaMare. Mr. LaMare is a noted social and political activist from South Sioux City, Nebraska, who has been involved for a long time with empowerment efforts for Native American peoples and others. He is a member of the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska. Frank has served for 8 years on the St. Michael's School Board of Education in South Sioux City and for 6 years on the Omaha Archdiocese School Board. He is a longstanding member of the Davis Chambers Scholarship Committee and at one time chaired the Nebraska Indian Community College Board of Trustees. Mr. LaMare remains a very active member on a number of social issues and is regarded as the architect of the effort to stop the illegal flow of alcohol from Nebraska onto the dry Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. He serves as the director of the Four Directions Center in Sioux City, Iowa, whose main focus is on juvenile justice and child welfare matters. He was recently honored by the Jackson Recovery Centers for his tireless effort to assist Native families and individuals in recovery. Mr. LaMare has a wealth of experience on many fronts, always seeking to give a voice to those who do not have one. Please join me in welcoming Mr. LaMare.
Thank you very much. I try to keep that just about a minute short so I could go a minute long. I wanted to, I'd be remiss if I did not send out a greeting to Dr. Muller, Dr. Rawhut, and Rich Galusha, and to extend best wishes to the Center for American Visions and Values. I'm very heartened by this, and I think that we'll be talking quite a lot. I simply will share a number of ideas with you tonight, but first and foremost, I want to say that as you get older, it gets simpler. And I've been involved in many, many things, and I've come to that realization that as you get older, it gets simpler. And I say that because it is in this discussion that we need to have. I think we're going to have to be very civil to one another. We're going to have to be good to one another if we're truly going to make some positive change. In everything that I do with regard to change anymore, I always talk about the importance of being good to one another, respecting one another. And the other thing that's very important for me to relate to this group tonight, and as you move forward with the initiative, that sometimes if you want to change things, you have got to make others uncomfortable. And that's not a trait, that's not human nature, that's not what we wish to do. But if we want to make things better for our children, for the generations to come, we have to make ourselves uncomfortable. Ask those questions respectfully. Come together, no matter from what perspective we come from, and talk about the future for our children. This film tonight, I seen something there. You know, the future, the education of our children, the generations to come, has become a game of chance. And I'm taken by that. I was moved by that. Should not be this way. This country, this city, this community, our school districts have the horses to meet the need in this country. But perhaps we have got to take a good hard look and fine-tune that approach and go back and talk about some values and principles that Dr. Mueller talked about, things we've left behind because we're entitled and these good things will automatically happen. Well, they don't. It takes work. And it takes resolve, and perhaps we in this discussion will even have to have a little talk about that. There was something that I heard tonight, you know, and something that I thought of during this documentary. And I know that we have a lot of movie aficionados in here, some of them my age. And I hearken back because they talked about how we need to change this. Ms. Reed talked about the need for fortitude, she said. And I think that's what really we're going to have to try to bring to the table as we gather. It reminded me of an old movie that was Dustin Hoffman was in, you know, many, many years ago. And he was talking, as some of you remember, on the Custer battlefield, little big man. He was talking on the Custer battlefield, and he was talking to General Custer, who was getting ready to go attack the Lakotas. And Dustin Hoffman said, "Don't do that." And General Custer, Richard Mulligan, looked at him and said, "You just don't want me to go down there because your heart's in it for the Lakota people. You really don't want me to go down there to even look at this." I remember in that movie, he said, Dustin Hoffman looked at him and he said, "You down there, if you've got the nerve." Really hit home tonight. You want to change things? We've got to make fundamental change in this country, fundamental change for our children. And I just hearken back to that. You down there, if you got the nerve. No matter how we approach this, we're going to have resolve, nerve, and commitment for that fundamental change. We have lost something in this country from the time that I was a young man in the school systems, I believe. And we've got to go back and find it. And I'm not smart enough to know what that is, but collectively we are. And I would say that, pleasure to be here tonight with you guys.
Thank you. It's my joy to introduce the next panelist. His office is next to mine, so I can say that if indeed we get more simple as we get older, then the simplest man on the panel tonight is Dr. John Spivak.
True.
Dr. Spivak was born in New York City on June 22, 1942, where he received later his BA degree from Columbia University and his law degree from the University of Florida. He also received a master's degree from the University of Florida, as well as his PhD with a dissertation in race, civil rights, and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Dr. Spivak is a professor of history here at Bellevue University from 1979 until the present, for a total of 92 years. Obviously, math was not your thing.
No.
Dr. Spivak's specialties include the Holocaust, baseball as an American icon, films as a cultural document, and just this semester, the Signature Series.
That's right.
Please join me in welcoming Dr. John Spivak.
Thank you very much. I look down at this panel and I see various minority groups represented. We have African Americans, we have Hispanic Americans, Native Americans, and I wondered what minority group I fit in, and then I figured it out. I'm a Jew, I'm a Democrat, and I'm a liberal. And you can't get much more minority than that in this. I thought the film was interesting. I am familiar with the work of Mr. Canada, and it's amazing. It confirmed for me that teachers are the key, and that whether we're talking about charter schools or magnet schools or private schools or parochial or public schools, if we have fine teachers and we support them, we're going to be in good shape. That causes me to be concerned about a number of things. The first is the quality of our education for teachers. How many of you have participated in courses in a college of education? Were you overwhelmingly challenged by those courses? Well, in the course of taking my master's degree, I had to take three courses in the College of Education, and I thought there was a good 2 weeks' worth of material in those three semesters' worth of work. Until we demand that our teachers receive the highest possible training, the highest possible education, we're not going to get a majority of good teachers. And a majority of good teachers, even in a union setting, and I must admit to you that in a past life, I was an attorney for the International Ladies Garment Workers and the Teamsters. Even in a union setting, those fine teachers will out. The second thing you ought to be concerned about that isn't touched on in the movie is that the performance of the children you're paying outrageous tuition for at this country's universities and colleges is woeful. And it is woeful because the standards that are being set for them in many cases are not where they should be. At Bellevue University, we have a unique student body. We have students who have families, who have full-time jobs, and all over the country, we have these new kinds of students. And for some reason, professors of my age, old guys, who thought we were really smart because only 15% of the graduating class went on to college, these new students can't possibly be as smart as we were. But the fact of the matter is, they are. And if you demand that they perform as if they are, they will. And so while I may not assign 25 books for a reading list for a student who has a full-time job and four children and goes to school two or three nights a week, the kind of thinking that we should demand of them is the same. And so when we're talking about education K through 12, I think you need to concern yourselves with the education that is taking place in higher education, and not just at local colleges and universities, but at places like Harvard. Because when Harvard has a class graduating 85% A, it tells me they don't have standards anymore either. One more thing. Since Dr. Rauhad took 2.5 times the amount of time he said he would as his introduction, he is returning all of his time to you.
Last but not least is Dr. Ed Rauhut, our other resident of born in New York City. Dr. Rauhut is the director of the Center for American Visions and Values and has a degree in teaching Shakespeare. He's the author of the Kirkpatrick Signature Series textbooks, as well as A Darn Dappy Dresser. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Ed Rauhut.
My wife told me I talked too long before, so I'm going to make this short. I taught in a school like that. I taught in one of those bad schools, and I'll never forget the experience. It was my first teaching assignment. I walked into the school. It looked like a bombed-out building, and it was. The students I taught, junior high school students, the majority of them, 97% of the kids in the school, were on the federal lunch program. They lived in public housing. They were on welfare. Most of them came from single-parent homes. The majority of them happened to be Puerto Rican kids. But the first thing I noticed when I saw these kids, and most of the time during the day they spent with busy work, their teachers gave them word puzzles to do while they were in the room. Some teachers worked hard and did their best and were doing a good job. Others sat, as you saw in the movie, reading newspapers for the better part of the day. When I saw these kids, what I saw were the same kids that I grew up with in the working class neighborhood that I grew up with. There was no difference. They were wise guys. And the first thing I did, or one of the first thing I did, after the desk I was standing in front of my very first day of class was flipped over, and the student told me something very obscene that I should do to myself and then ran out. The first thing I did was I got rid of the puzzles. I went into a workroom that I would later be blown off my feet into when someone set a bomb off in the school. I discovered a set of Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. I went back to the classroom and told my students, we're going to read Shakespeare. Within 2 weeks, they were reading Shakespeare. These kids, as I say, they lived in the same six-story tenements that every other group of ethnic people who had come to America through Ellis Island lived in. Those prior generations of immigrants had used those tenements as launching pads into the American middle class. My students were wards of the state. They were on welfare for 3, 4, and sometimes 5 generations. When I asked one of my young students what her goal in life was, she said it was to be independent. When I asked her what that meant, she said to get on my own welfare. When I told my colleagues that we were doing these students an enormous disservice, I was told by my colleagues that I was a racist and that was racist thinking. I set the same standards for those students that I would have wanted a teacher to set for my children. Within 2 weeks, they were reading Julius Caesar and understanding it and acting it out, and they liked it because there were, you know, there was knife fights in it and everything else.
You're terrible.
One of the students I sensed was a little bit resentful, and I went over to him one day and I said, "What's the matter? What are you?" He said, "How come nobody ever made us do this before?" And I said, and I looked at him and I said, "Because they think you're stupid. And now you know different. And you can go out and you can do whatever you darn well please." I agree with, you know, what our other panelists are saying. We raise the bar and the students will rise to our expectations. How do you change a dysfunctional system like this? I remember reading this famous French philosopher, Michel Foucault, and he said, when you're in a dysfunctional bureaucracy, the question not to ask is, why doesn't it work? Because there'll be too many answers. The question to ask is, in whose interest does it function the way that it does? And I would argue it functions in the interest of a number of special interest groups, primarily, as we saw in the movie, the teachers' union. And I would argue that the only way to reform the present system is through privatization and a system of vouchers in which parents, the very parents we saw in that movie, are given an educational voucher and they themselves can decide which school they want to send their kids to, which school would best educate their child. I trust those parents to make that decision more than I trust any bureaucrat in the public educational system to do what might be in what they think is the best interest of a child. So there's my silver bullet, and I have boiled it down to a black and white situation that infuriates my colleague Dr. John Spivak. Thank you.
I'm glad your wife told you to keep it short. As you can tell, Ed and John and I know each other pretty well, and Eduardo is becoming a friend as well here at work. Now, this is the part where we're going to ask you to ask questions. So if you have a question, please raise your hand, and the young men with the microphones will come to you. I'd like to start it off with a question for Mr. Freeman, though, who is a constitutional scholar. In our Declaration of Independence, it claimed that all men are created equal, and we know that that means equality in terms of opportunity. In your opinion, as a nation, have we failed to fulfill this promise in terms of providing quality education to all our citizens?
Yes, yes, we have. But I want to go, you were talking about Shakespeare, I want to go to Gaius Cassius, who was talking to Brutus. And he said, my dear Brutus, the fault lies not in the stars, but in ourselves. So I'm speaking for the black kids, not African-American kids, black kids I'm speaking for. I've had three that's gone to school. I have three that's done quite well. What I see wrong with the education system now has absolutely nothing to do with the opportunity. Minority students, black students, have the opportunity to go to school. The problem, and I agree with Reverend Ford, the problem doesn't lie with the unions. The problem lies with the expectation of black kids, the expectations. We, like I said earlier, the idea that we are not good at math is unbelievable. I don't know who could think that up, but we are not good at math. So if that child, and every time I lecture, I try to make a point of that. If that kid is not good at math when he or she walks in the door, and you believe that she's not good at math, when they walk out of that door, they won't be good at math. It's just that simple. Now, I don't subscribe to any idea that this is so complex we can't resolve it. There are silver bullets. And if given the opportunity, I will give them to you today. There are silver bullets.
I'm Dr. Dick Galusha, and you've talked about change up there. So I'd like to ask you the question, because we're looking for changes here in Nebraska. What is your opinion of the Nebraska learning community, and how successful is your prediction for it to improve education in the state?
May I say something?
Yes.
My sense is that the learning community is simply another layer of bureaucracy. I can't imagine what it could have possibly accomplished, except of course for spending more tax dollars. In a perverse sort of way, and maybe even not a perverse sort of way, I liked Ernie Chambers' idea. And I know that my friend, Mr. Freeman, also does, where he divided the OPS school district into three areas, South Omaha, North Omaha, and then the rest. And each of those parts of the community would be in charge of their own schools. And I've spoken to Mr. Freeman about this notion. In other words, local schools controlled by the community. And I think it's an exciting prospect. I think it would, but no, the learning community, just another level of bureaucracy. I can't imagine it accomplishing anything.
Thank you. Dr. Perez?
I think Nebraska is doing pretty good. I mean, if we're doing a little more in test scores and in performance, if you take it geographically, much better than the South, Mississippi, Tennessee. We have to look nationally. If we want to compare upwards, who perhaps aren't doing too well compared to the East Coast. So it's relative compared to what area we are comparing Nebraska to and what state we're comparing it to. It's really complicated when we look at how different states perform nationally and geographically by region.
May I just throw in one more thing? I don't know if anyone knows, but Mr. Galusha and I ran for the school board, and was it 89, Dick? And one of us won, and I'm not saying who it is.
Could I address
yes,
that
yes,
question?
Please.
Back to the Learning Center. It's I want you to understand what I say. None of this, and I'm speaking for black kids. None of this is hard. Absolutely none of it. We have to go back first to the old reading, writing, arithmetic. You've heard that before. That's the first thing we have to do. But see, when I go to school today, the way that I make it in life is I either play basketball or football. That's it. See, that's the way you make it. So what am I going to school for? I'm going to school to play basketball or football. Now, at first, the Learning Center is an extension of that great program of busing. See, all we do is just take these black kids out of North Omaha, Northwest Washington, D.C., and put them in class by this white kid, and he'll learn through osmosis. That's all it takes. He is just, I mean, white kids are just so smart, they're just riding on the bus. That's all it takes. All that I want you to clearly understand, this is not hard. This is not hard at all. But if you stop playing the gimmicks, and that's what you're doing with the Learning Center, and that's what you did with busing. Because you do that, because I am not good at math. I am not good at this and that. The only thing that I can do is play basketball, play football, and I can dance because we got rhythm. Now, you think that's facetious. If you think that's facetious, but I am telling you, that if you don't, when my kid goes into that class and he or she can only do basketball, football, that's how you make it in this world. And you're going to tell me that that will not affect that kid? It does. I want you to listen to me. Your expectation is where the problem lies.
Thank you.
Can I piggyback on what you said? Violence is about to break out. I think one of the things we need to remember here is that we have exactly the kind of education we want. This is exactly what we want, because this is what we're willing to pay for. This is how we designed it. If we want it to be something else, it's up to us to do something about it. I happen to believe in our system. I believe in our political system. And the politics and the education that we have today is what we decided on, not somebody else. So when we're pointing fingers about education, this is where the finger ought to go, right to ourselves.
Okay, we're going to try another question here.
Back when I was at school, you know, back in, we won't say when, but back then we used to always be inundated with the message that, you know, for us to strive to be the best at whatever it is that we do. And my parents reinforced that message. Every time, they always told me whatever I did, they told me to be the best at what I did, to strive to be the best. And which comes down to competition. Now, I think competition drives innovation, it drives resourcefulness. When I worked in manufacturing, because I wanted my department to be the best, it drove me to be resourceful in how I approach situations, and which brought about innovation and change, and we became the best. Now, there's over the years, there's been an effort to kind of level the playing field. In other words, remove competition from the equation. And I want to know, how detrimental do you think that was in education in America?
Well, when you say level playing field, again, we come up with that great gimmick of affirmative action. You see, all of these programs destroy the incentive and the initiative of black kids. Affirmative action is an insult. Busing was an insult. Now the learning community is an insult. You continue to insult me, but then tell me that I'm not doing what I should be doing. All of those are insults to me. You haven't given me. When are you going to give me the opportunity to fail or achieve based upon my own merits? But you tell me when I come from a single parent. I come from a broken, all kind of stuff. I was poor. All of this has nothing to do with my brains. It's the application. It's what we're talking about. It's the expectations that what we're talking about. This is not difficult. I say it again. But if you keep introducing affirmative action, busing, the learning community, or he's not good at math, you do all of that, and you grow up for years. None of this happened past the 60s. Once we had the 60s came in, and everyone was going to help me out, we're going to help those poor black folks out. And look what you've done to us. 7 out of 10 of our babies today are born out of wedlock. 70% of them. Now you tell me, how are we going to achieve when we have babies having babies? We got grandmothers that are 35 years of age. How can we make it? And you tell me you're helping me out, and you tell me I'm not good at math, and you tell me we need busing, and now we need the learning center. Thank you.
Could I just want to add to what Larry said about competition. I think that's a force that would certainly set education free and certainly improve it. Right now, we have a system in which all the incentives seem to be misaligned. When public education receives our tax dollars automatically, I mean, imagine if we ran our supermarkets in the same way. Would we expect quality and service from our supermarkets? I hardly think so. I think if we compel the schools to compete for our education tax dollars, we can expect real reform and real change. At the very least, the schools would become responsive to the kinds of things that we do want when we point to ourselves and say, this is what we want. The schools would have to be responsive because we would hold the educational tax dollars. Thank you.
Mr. LeMaire.
Yeah, I wanted just to kind of follow up on what I'm telling you. It takes me a little time to process, so I usually run about 5 minutes behind. But, you know, this discussion could go a whole different way, so I'll kind of leave it alone. But I got to point out, and I'm not disagreeing with anybody, but economics drives things. We're talking about competition. Economics drives the economy. The economy determines whether we make it or whether we don't make it. But I think that's a whole different discussion. Because Native people, you know, we're much in the same boat, but we're left out of that equation when it comes to jobs in Woodbury County, Iowa. That's right now. That's 2011. So I want to point that out. The discussion of the economy, given that opportunity to live, grow, flourish, be in the workforce, we don't have it yet. I want to share that. There's something else I want to go back to because I'd be remiss if I didn't. We talked a little bit about the state of education in Nebraska right now. I went to public schools here many years ago. I will tell you something. My child going across town, going to school over here at Creighton is a product of private education in the parochial, the Catholic school system. And I worked on our board for a number of years. I served as a chair for 1 year, and I, you know, just remember basically the percentages. We had 32% of what a child in the state of Nebraska gets to be educated. That's what we had, 32% of those dollars. When they were getting $7,000-$8,000, we were getting $2,600 to educate our children. We still had a good workforce, had good teachers. We did, like I think all of us in this country once did, and some still do, we do the most with the least because there's a commitment to something. It's a commitment to our children and building a future. And that doggone girl got more credits in the first semester than I got in the first 6 years of my life. So something happened there. The other thing I want to bring up, Rich, I really want to bring this up because we can kind of beat ourselves up a little bit and be critical of ourselves and be critical of the children. There's something that's always missing. And as a Native person, I bring it up to you, to others here, and they never really grab onto it. Somebody needs to do a study. We have one of the things I think that gets in the way for even our Native children, even right now, and somebody said this. They talked about Ellis Island. We have lost in this country rites of passage. There we have people, the Super Bowl, that's a part of our culture, that's 45 years old. NASCAR is our culture, that's 20 years old. There were rites of passage that we had when all of our forebears began to come to the cities. And when they got to Ellis Island, they couldn't spell some of your names out here. So they changed it to Smith and to Jones, something that they could spell. And what they did is they took away everything that you had that caused you to live, to grow, and to flourish. They took it away from you because you're an American now. And you went along with it. Indian people kind of didn't go along with it. We try to hold on to something. And here's what I'm trying to tell you. There's a reason our children are the way they are. There's a reason they hang out on the corner and gravitate to gangs and hang out at the mall and shoot out the streetlights and get involved with all this graffiti. And you know what that is? Every one of us, when we're 15 and 16 and 17, man or woman, we get to thinking one time, you know, there's something I'm supposed to be doing. There's something I'm supposed to be doing. It's human nature. 10,000 years taught us that. We lost it. We don't have it. We take a look at all these things going on with our children. We blame them and we blame their teachers. We blame everybody. There's no rites of passage, no responsibility entitled to these things. And we've got to go back, all of us, and find that. The Winnebagos are trying to find that. We're going back to our rites of passage. When you turn 15, they tell you something. And that is, we get our kids, we get our young men and said, here's what you do now. You fast all the time so you can understand. And you watch how you carry yourself in the village, lest others look down upon you and your family. And then number three, we say, watch how you interact with the opposite sex, lest people think that you do not know your role in the village, your responsibility to the village. We've all forgotten that. Somewhere in this discussion, we've got to go back. Instead of blaming them, fill that in, that void.
Thank you. Right over here.
First of all, I don't think that parents or the community fund the schools anymore. I think there's so many layers of funding going all the way up to the White House that there was a time, you know, when your child came home and you said, read me the newspaper. And if the child couldn't read the newspaper, you called the school and you said, this teacher's not working out very well. My child's not reading. And if they got enough complaints, the teacher was out of there. But we don't fund the schools. We don't control the schools anymore.
I'd really love to respond to you, and I think you brought up something very important. Today in the schools, the teachers who are under pressure are the ones who are not giving out good grades. I want to repeat that. The teachers under pressure are the ones who are setting standards and enforcing standards, and we had English teachers at Bellevue East High School who were told they couldn't give out as many Fs as they had given out. And they were being honest. They were evaluating the work, and they were being told, no, you can't do that. One other thing, you want to know where the money's going? How many of you know what the assistant superintendent of education in Sarpy County makes? $210,000, folks. The assistant superintendent.
That's nothing compared to what John McKeel makes.
My name is Tyler McCabe, and I'm an ambassador to the Kirkpatrick series. But my question is directed specifically at you, Dr. Spivak.
Yes.
Mostly because I was told I'd get extra credit if I did this.
Who put you up to this?
I have no idea, but he's sitting to your left.
Okay.
In reality, you spoke earlier. You discussed we're getting the education we paid for, and we need to be directing our concerns back at ourselves in a large part. And in the movie, they specifically pointed out the increase in cost per student did virtually nothing to the education levels. And I guess my question is this just a simple case of figures lie and liars figure, or are you suggesting we give alcohol to an alcoholic to make them sober up?
Good question. I think that the answer in the film, someone says money helps, but money isn't the answer. We need to spend more on education because it's vital for us. Is spending more money the answer? No, it's not. Requiring responsibility, requiring accountability, People are often saying, you know, it's bureaucracy, it's too much of this, it's too much of that. It's not that it's too much of one thing or too much of another. It's just that these people are no darn good. It's that we are not requiring people to do their jobs. And our definition of management today is, instead of dealing with an individual who is failing, we say, well, what's the easiest thing to do? Oh, I know, I'll make a blanket rule that applies to everyone. Most of the abuses that we have in running systems, it seems to me, come from this refusal to deal with specific instances. You've got a lousy teacher. Fire him. The union is going to say, no, you can't. You're going to go to court. Fight the court battle. Spend the money. And once the union loses, because it will lose regardless of the contract, if you demonstrate with your tape, I've got a teacher who's reading the newspaper during class, the union will be, I think, chastened a bit. So is it just money? Good God, no. Mm-hmm. But it's part of it.
All right. Well, let's wind it up. We appreciate everyone coming tonight. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program from Bellevue University on Noon Forum. We have heard a panel discussion on the topic, The State of Public Education in America Today, which followed a special screening of the 2010 documentary film Waiting for Superman, directed by Davis Guggenheim. The members of the panel have included Reverend Dwight Ford, pastor and co-founder of Grace City Church, Dr. Eduardo Perez, professor of sociology at Bellevue University, Glenn Freeman, president of the Omaha chapter of the Freedom Foundation at Valley Forge, Frank LeMaire, a member of the Board of Education of the Archdiocese of Omaha and the director of the Ford Direction Center in Sioux City, Iowa, Dr. John Spivak, professor of history at Bellevue University, and Dr. Ed Rauhut, the director of the Center for American Vision and Values at Bellevue University, which sponsored the event. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, May 11, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jim Maxwell, Assistant Director of Public Relations at Bellevue University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.